Cincinnati 6-2. White Sox and Oakland rained out last night in Chicago. Tonight, the Brewers and Cardinals meet again at Miller Park. Cubs play the Reds again in Cincinnati. The White Sox will try again with Oakland down at the Cell. Northwoods League Baseball, the Kenosha Kingfish lost to Kalamazoo 9-3 last night. The two teams play again tonight in Kalamazoo. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday, June 22nd. Cloudy and breezy, rain showers throughout the day, a high of 66. 50-50 chance of more rain tonight, but then a rain-free weekend. That's what they're telling us now. Saturday, cloudy and 73. Sunday, partly sunny and 77. Rain moving through the area now, 60 degrees in Racine, 59 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. Support for WGTD and the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
My guest for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show is Barbara Kahn, the Patty and Jay Baker Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Kahn has been paying attention to us and to our shopping habits for quite a number of years and has written previous books, including Global Brand Power, Leveraging Branding for Long-Term Growth, and she is co-author of The Grocery Revolution, The New Focus on the Consumer. Her latest book called The Shopping Revolution, How Successful Retailers Win Customers in an Era of Endless Disruption. This book, published by Wharton Digital Press, explores some of the dramatic ways in which the way we shop has changed so drastically over recent years. It charts, for instance, the rapid rise of Amazon and its utter domination of so many fields, about the way in which online shopping in general has become so predominant, how certain retailers are still doing well and why certain other retailers are struggling mightily and perhaps even winking out of existence. She covers a lot in her book. Again, it's called The Shopping Revolution. And Professor Barbara Kahn, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Boy, this is an interesting time to be in the line of work in which you are. That is, you are writing about a period that is certainly turbulent and undergoing all kinds of rapid growth. I'm just curious, at the time that you entered this field of academia, what kinds of issues were you exploring then versus what you are exploring and charting now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned a couple of books that I wrote, and I wrote one in the mid-90s, The Grocery Revolution, and that one was charting Walmart's ascent. And Walmart, when Walmart used to come to town, all the little mom-and-pop retailers would go out of business because Walmart had identified a new model that was really resonating with consumers, which was everyday low pricing. And they could undercut price of all the retailers in the neighborhood, and nobody could compete. And they were the big giant that revolutionized customer behavior and retailing at the time. So it's interesting to see now, 20 years later, Amazon doing it in a different way.
Mm. So in some ways, it's the same story, just playing out with different specifics, different details.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting also about, you know, what you were saying, the rapid ascent of Amazon. But really, Amazon started in 1997. So they've been doing this for 20 years, slowly but carefully building up their strategy. And I in the book, I present the theory that Bezos knew what he was doing from the beginning, you know, and it was a very methodical strategy. And to me, the secret to his strategy was that, and he says this all the time, that he was maniacally focused on the consumer. You know, that's such a simple idea, but it's very powerful when you really, really mean it.
Well, and I guess it depends on what you mean by rapid, because yes, in some respects, especially in this day and age in which we live, 20 years is a long, long time, and 1997 is almost ancient history. On the other hand, in terms of the grand scope of things, it sure feels, to a lot of us at least, like so much has changed nearly overnight.
Well, I think there is truth to what you're saying, both, regardless of whether you think 20 years is a long or short time, because I don't think people recognize what Amazon was doing until very recently. And then all of a sudden, it was a huge wake-up call. So I do think there was this sense that this just happened.
So you spell out in your book a statistic that I don't remember seeing anyplace else, although I suppose it is certainly out there, and namely that at the moment, 30% of all shopping is done online. First of all, I would love for you to unpack that statistic for us a little bit, if there are specifics within it that might be enlightening for us to know. And I also am very curious to know if we have charted whether or not that is a figure that it pretty much encompasses, first of all, the entire country. I mean, all regions of the country, all economic levels, all age groups. I mean, by and large, are all of us doing 30% of our shopping online?
Yeah, and, you know, I don't remember exactly where I got that statistic from. I'm sure I have a site for it, but it changes daily. But you're absolutely right. That's a broad average from whenever it was taken, and it's just not true across different areas of the country, different types of people, and product categories. So, for example, electronics and books, well, let's look at books. Books, a lot of books are being sold online, but food, not as much. So that's a very interesting area to see if that changes. One of the areas that people were really looking at was apparel, whether or not people would buy clothing online, and Amazon's been showing a lot of growth in that area. Some people forecasted it would never sell online because people have to try the clothing on, but apparently that's not true, or they're willing to try it on at home and return that doesn't fit. It is also true that it's not everybody. So there's one very interesting sector of the retail environment, to me anyway, is the growth of Dollar General stores. So when all these other stores are competing in one landscape, Dollar General is building new stores. And typically those people don't shop online, the people who shop at those Dollar General. And so there are markets for people who may not have credit cards, they may not have access to online. And so you're seeing growth in different areas.
Interesting. One term I saw in your book that I don't remember seeing anyplace else is the term overstored. I think it's a hyphenated word, but overstored, and that refers, as probably our listeners can discern pretty easily, to the fact that at least in certain places, and maybe in many, many places, we have too many stores, many more stores than current demand can possibly keep afloat. Talk for a moment about this phenomenon. And again, kind of as I was asking you about the 30% online shopping statistic, are we talking about all across the board or in particular regions or in particular sectors of the economy that America is seriously overstored at the moment?
I don't know about particular regions of the country, but in general, the idea was that in the U.S., and this is compared to the rest of the world, there are many more stores for the number of people we are than there is in other areas of the world. So this is a phenomenon that's particularly true for the U.S. and maybe a little less true in other parts of the world. And so what's interesting about that statistic or that fact is that regardless of all these other changes with Amazon and Generation Z and the mobile shopping and all these other things that people know are very big changes that are affecting retail, there probably would have been a shakeout in stores anyway because we just had too much supply. And so they categorize malls by A, B, C, with A being the best malls and C being the worst malls. And the first stores that are closing are in these B and C malls, which really have kind of outlived their usefulness. They're not fun to go shopping in. They've been empty. They've been deserted. People, that's where a lot of the online shopping is taken from, because why would you want to go to a boring, awful store experience when it's much easier to shop online? But the A stores and the flagship stores and some of the new interesting stores, they're still doing well. And I don't think anybody's predicting the end of the physical store. I think it's just kind of an evening out of the landscape.
Interesting. So in other words, brick and mortar is not going to vanish, despite the fact that certain people might be saying that is a vast, first of all, oversimplification. And it sounds like you think it's just an out-and-out mistake to say that.
Yeah, I don't think physical retail is going away, but I do think it's morphing, and I think expectations are changing. So I think, especially with the younger consumers, but more and more everyone, people expect a seamless integration from online shopping, mobile shopping, and physical store. They may browse on their phone and pick up in the store. They may look in the store to try something, go home and buy it online. And so they expect all of those different interfaces to be connected. And when you have all those interfaces connected, you also generate what people are calling big data. And so you're seeing, you know, with these new algorithms and machine learning and new statistical analyses, people using this data to better understand the consumer and hopefully provide better shopping experiences.
We're speaking with Barbara Kahn about her newest book, which is called The Shopping Revolution: How Successful Retailers Win Customers in an Era of Endless Disruption. You spell out some different success stories, and one of them, which we've already touched on briefly, is that of Amazon.com, the big behemoth when it comes to online shopping, which at one point you refer to in your book as a frictionless retailer, a retailer evidently without friction. Explain to our listeners what is behind this intriguing term.
Again, this is my interpretation. It's based on a lot of reading and a lot of discussion, but just a caveat, this is what I think is happening, is that Amazon is focused on the consumer, and they want to make shopping convenient and easy, and so take out all the pain points. And a lot of what their new innovations are is to take out the friction or the pain in the shopping experience. And it started in 1997 with their one-click shopping. This was very surprising to me when I did the research on this, that they patented the idea of one-click shopping. And the patent didn't expire until last year. Now, what's interesting to me about that is, first of all, that was a patentable idea. And also, it's a metaphor for how I think they thought shopping should be. It should be super easy, just one click. And just to put it in context, that wasn't the thinking at the time. People used to think about ways to keep customers on their website. How can you engage the customer? How can you get the customer deeper and deeper into the website? More time on the website would mean more shopping. But Amazon turned that on its head and said, no, make it as easy as possible for the customer. And that's going to engage the customer. And a lot of their innovations have been that. The one they most recently introduced was the Just Walk Out Shopping in their new store in Seattle, where you can walk in, log into your Amazon app, do all your shopping, and just walk out. So you don't have to do what most consumers indicate was the worst part of the shopping experience, after they were done shopping, waiting in line to pay at the cashier.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting to hear you describe it that way. I'm reminded of the fact that, I mean, I happen to be someone who's old-fashioned enough that I still like walking into a nice department store. But one of the things that is just maddening about so many department stores is you can't even find where the cash registers are. I mean, they aren't right as you walk in or walk out of the store. They tend to be kind of sprinkled, but often sort of out of the way. And moreover, often when you'd find the cash register, there'd be a line, and it just would sort of take forever. And if you are someone who does not thrive on those sorts of situations where you are in a hurry, have someplace else to go, and hate standing in line, I mean, that would be an example of the kind of friction that a shopper is likely to experience, at least in a lot of department stores, for instance. And what you're talking about here is Amazon creating a shopping experience in which there is no friction whatsoever.
Yeah, and what's interesting about your example in the department store is a lot of these department stores that are being threatened by Amazon, they're losing profitability and they're cutting costs. And so what they're doing is they're reducing sales associates in the store, which makes the shopping experience even worse and makes them even more vulnerable. You can kind of see how they get into that rut, but it's not a good response.
And one can see how then we have this kind of downward spiral from which a lot of department stores are really struggling to escape. What other kinds of innovations has Amazon been responsible for? What are some of the key factors that have been so vital to their success?
Well, I mean, one-click shopping was their first thing. Then, of course, people talk about the flywheel of Amazon being Amazon Prime, their loyalty program. And Jeff Bezos just indicated in his last letter that there's, I think he said, 100 million subscribers to Amazon Prime in the U.S. Some estimates say about 60% of American households are shopping on Amazon online now. So that loyalty program, what the data show is, the more you're a Prime member, the more time you spend online, the more you spend overall. And people, the retention rates in Amazon Prime are very, very high. I think they're over 95%. Once you become an Amazon Prime member, you're just locked in. And that is an amazing kind of control over customers. And I think that's, and a lot of people say this, that's the flywheel. That's where Amazon gets a lot of their power and control over the marketplace, that they have these customers that are very, very loyal to them. And then just recently, last holiday season, they, you know, cut prices on Amazon Echoes and Alexa entered people's lives. And that is a new way people are forecasting people will shop in the future as well.
What, if anything, do you see as ramifications from some of the enormous concerns that have emerged about data being captured and misused, or things like identity theft, or other ways in which I think more and more of us are waking up to the potential dangers of our activity online, including our shopping? Do any of those concerns seem to be, in a sense, hurting somebody like Amazon?
Well, you know, obviously that is a definite concern, and everything that happened with Facebook, you know, just really delineated that concern, and people are right to be worried about it. But what's interesting is now with the new regulations coming in and everybody's getting all these emails and all these notifications, you know, that you have to understand that you have these privacy, you're giving away your privacy, the website's collecting cookies, all this kind of stuff. My sense is people are just clicking through it and not reading it, you know. So there may be some people who are very worried and it makes them completely wipe out their Facebook accounts and get offline. But I think it's become such a part of everyday life that people are just resigned to it and hope nothing happens to them. But what I think that means, and I think a lot of the customers are hoping this is what it means, is that the companies themselves will do a better job policing this data and using it appropriately. And the retailers who show that they are, that you can believe in, that you can trust them, they'll get the customer support for that behavior.
Are you seeing any evidence that with a place like Amazon that is creating a shopping experience that, as we were saying earlier, is so frictionless that it is, in effect, preying upon certain people who are probably prone to addiction, that is, addiction to shopping and getting themselves into terrible trouble? Or, generally speaking, are we becoming a bit more savvy and less prone to those kind of disastrous overuses of shopping with a place like Amazon?
Yeah, that's an interesting hypothesis. I haven't really seen any evidence of that or anybody discussing that when I was looking through, you know, all the articles and talking to people. I hadn't really heard people say that. I suppose that is possible, that, you know, making shopping too easy might not be good for some people, but I haven't really heard about that.
One of the points of your book is not just to highlight the great success of Amazon, but also to kind of pose the question, is Amazon invulnerable? I mean, does Amazon have anything to be worried about? are there ways in which Amazon faces challenges and difficulties in retaining its point of primacy in the landscape of online shopping? What kinds of things does Amazon need to be thinking about if it wants to retain this extraordinary level of success and dominance of the field?
Well, their Amazon Prime program does make them, you know, hard to beat. So that is one thing that I think is a really good strategy. But in any competitive industry, there will be competition that will force people to continue to innovate and to continue to compete. So I think there's two primary ways that people, that successful retailers, are competing against Amazon. One is head-to-head with different areas of strength. And for that way, I would point out something like Walmart, which is really trying to compete head-to-head with Amazon. Amazon has frictionless shopping, and also they leverage that to also offer the lowest prices. Now, Walmart comes in it from a different perspective. They were, as I mentioned before, this operationally excellent company, a very, very good logistics, taking out all the costs in their systems. And they built all these stores. There's some estimates that 90% of Americans live within 10 miles of a Walmart, and they're the largest private employer in the U.S. So they have this physical presence, and they have this operational excellence, so they can really bring down prices. And then they're going to leverage that advantage to try to make shopping more convenient. But they're leveraging their stores and their customer, you know, their sales associates to make shopping easier. So they're advertising, you know, shop online, pick up in the store, or they have programs where their sales associates will deliver the products to their customers on their way home. So they're trying to compete head-to-head, but from different areas of strength. The other way that people can compete is by looking for something that's not just reducing the pain, but increasing pleasure. Because people talk about Amazon as, you know, the basic brown box. It's easy and it's cheap, and those are great values, but it's not as much fun or as pleasurable as some other types of shopping experiences might be. And so the luxury brands offer something that's very different from Amazon. Or the really cool store experiences like a Sephora or an Ely will offer something that's very different from Amazon and will cater to different customer segments.
Right. And so there is something kind of exciting and fun about walking into the store. I mean, it's an experience that people are very likely to enjoy, in the same way that you might go to a movie or go to a restaurant or go to a park. Going to some of these really spectacular retail spaces will be very enticing for a certain kind of customer.
Right. And, you know, maybe even the same customer, they want to do some easy shopping and some fun shopping. One of the things I thought was interesting when I was looking at this is the Costco experience. So Costco also competes on low price, but they have a fun store experience. They call it the treasure hunt. You never know what you're going to find in Costco. They also offer gas, so you have to physically take your car to Costco, and while you're there, you might as well go shopping. And one of the things I found is, I forget now exactly what the proportion, but there is a significant proportion of people that had Amazon Prime membership and Costco membership. And my first hypothesis when I was just anecdotally talking to people was that they'd give up one of them. Why do you need both? They sell a lot of the same products. But the people I talked to, and this is not a scientific survey, but I just talked to people, they were saying they had no intentions right now of giving either of them up because they fill different needs.
Hmm. And I guess that's underscores the point of not thinking about all of this too simplistically. That we're all sweeping towards this one thing, when in fact part of the whole point of being, in a sense, spoiled by too many choices is that we want to have an array of choices. We sometimes want to walk into a store. We don't want, even those of us who do a fair amount of online shopping, we don't want brick-and-mortar stores to vanish off the face of the earth. I don't think anybody wants that. Well, maybe Jeff Bezos does, but none of the rest of us do.
Selling stores, too.
I wonder if you could say a word about really small retailers. I mean, somebody who would have had a small little corner boutique or small little antique business or somebody who makes their own jewelry or that kind of thing. In this era of online shopping, what should somebody with really small businesses like that be thinking about?
You know, I mean, I was thinking about that also. I just went to the Shore this weekend, and in the Shore, there's all these little stores owned by, you know, one family, and that's their family business. And the lines were out the door at these stores, you know? So even in the age of Amazon, it would still took me 45 minutes to eat a sandwich at this store at the Shore. And I think what that idea is that if you're a small retailer and you're catering really well to a specific niche, then that will work. You know, that will continue to work. It may be harder to scale, but not everybody needs to be a behemoth. You know, they're fine with really catering first-class service or really catering to a hard-to-meet customer's needs.
So where do you see all of this going? Do we know where all of this is ultimately going?
You know, it's funny. When I give these talks, and I've been giving a lot of talks about this, you know, I look around the room and I say, is Amazon a good guy or a bad guy? And usually the room is split. In terms of delivering customer value, people think Amazon's a great guy. They just are really happy with their shopping experiences. If you have to compete against Amazon, maybe they're a little bit of a ruthless competitor. And Bezos seems not afraid to say things like that. But then in the end, what some people will say is, but net-net, what Amazon has done is forced subpar retailers to close their stores and has raised the bar for everybody to create better customer experiences. And that's a good thing.
Well, we can read about much more of this in your fascinating book called The Shopping Revolution, How Successful Retailers Win Customers in an Era of Endless Disruption. The book is published by Wharton Digital Press. The author, Barbara Kahn. Professor Kahn, I have really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about an important new book called Your Score, An Insider's Secrets to Understanding, Controlling, and Protecting Your Credit Score. The author of the book, Anthony Davenport, knows a lot about what a credit report is. In fact, in some respects, he has worked on both teams or both sides of the aisle, if you will. But since 2010, has been working on behalf of borrowers and customers rather than working for lenders. He founded in 2010 a credit management firm that represents all kinds of different clients and helps people understand their credit score and perhaps just as important, understand the ways in which that credit score can be improved. This book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, again called Your Score. Anthony Davenport, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. So let's go into a little more detail on what I touched on in the introduction, namely that you have worked sort of both sides of the ball. I don't know if you were a football player at one point, but I think most people will understand the metaphor. But explain a little more clearly what you used to do and what you do now and how both of those help you understand this whole business of the credit report and credit score.
Yeah, so I was a banker for 10 years. I started off at Bank of America, and then I went to work for Wells Fargo, and my job was to get people loans. And I kept seeing that people were not getting the best rates or getting the best programs because their credit score was a few points off or wasn't quite the profile that the lending institutions were looking for. So I began digging and saying, like, hey, how can I help people get the credit score that will get them the very best rate? They'll love me a lot more. They'll send me referrals and whatnot. And over time, I realized that I actually hated being a banker. I didn't like the process of dragging people through the mud to get these loans, but that I really enjoyed helping them understand their credit because people didn't know about this whole system, how it works. If you were to ask people how many credit cards should you have or what kind of balances they should have on their credit cards, you get a lot of blank stares. So I really dug in deep to learn how you can manage this whole process, how you can build, how you can repair, how you can protect your credit, because I found that there's just a ton of misinformation out there. And now I'm atoning for my sins as a banker for 10 years by helping consumers understand and control their credit from all walks of life. We work with about half our clients are professional athletes and entertainers, and the other half are just regular people that need some help, you know, getting a handle on this whole thing.
Right. And you point out at one point in the book that a lot of us who live more ordinary lives with more ordinary means might be kind of shocked to think that a well-paid professional athlete or a well-paid professional musician might be in some trouble when it comes to something like their credit report. I mean, with one presumes mountains of money in the bank. But as you point out, their situation can, in fact, be very, very complicated, and it's very, very easy for someone even in that kind of situation to get themselves into some trouble regarding their own credit profile.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat. So what people don't understand is that even if you're rich, the banks are not bending to you. Their whole existence is about getting as much money from you as humanly possible. And they love the credit system the way that it is, the way that people don't understand what goes into it and are just kind of wandering around thinking, well, I make a lot of money, I pay my bills on time, so my credit must be good. But in reality, only 35% of your FICO score comes down to whether you pay your bills on time. So 65% of it has nothing to do with whether you pay your bills on time. So that's how people that, even if you're rich and you make a lot of money or you're famous, you can still get caught in the same trap as the rest of us because you don't know what that other 65% is, and there's a lot of misinformation about it. And the banks are not going to tell you how to play this game at all. They want you to be kept in the dark.
Before we go into a little more detail about exactly how one's credit report is put together and, for that matter, just how to read the thing, I wonder if you could expound on something that you say in the preface of the book where you describe our current situation or landscape as a different world. That is a very different world from what it was, for instance, 25 or 30 years ago. How have things changed, and how and why have they changed?
So things really started to change during the Great Recession, when the whole banking industry started to collapse and change. The downside, there's a lot of downsides to it, but one of the biggest downsides is that the bank started using this as an opportunity to make changes and hurt consumers in ways that they didn't before. One of them is that they came up with something called risk-based pricing. Didn't really exist a whole lot before. So back when I was a mortgage banker, if you had a 620 FICO score, for example, you got the loan, and you got the loan at the same rate as someone who had a 700 score. They just gave you the rate. But since then, they started coming up with these tranches of every 20 points, you're now in a different bucket. And they can penalize you for not having the optimal score, which is a 740. So if you have a 700 score, that's pretty good. but a 740 score gets you a significantly better interest rate and better options and programs. So that's the biggest change in this whole thing, is that now credit scores are being dissected by every 20 points to give you a different rate. And the second biggest thing that's been going on is that now they're starting to use credit scores and credit reports for every aspect of life in the modern times. So if you want to get a job, 70% of employers are checking your credit. If you want to rent an apartment, they're obviously going to check it. If you're going to get a mortgage, a car loan, of course, and obviously credit cards. But now it's even being used for auto and home insurance. They're tying correlations between your credit score to whether or not your house is going to burn down and you're going to make a claim. And trust me, I don't know how they're justifying this, but it's another way of saying, hey, if you have a 600 score, we're going to make you pay more for this than if you have an immaculate 740 or higher score.
I think it says a lot about this topic that we're talking about, that there's a whole section in your book that is devoted to just helping people read their credit report or credit score and understand what's there. That really, in a nutshell, kind of tells us that this is a relatively complicated business. Let's talk first of all about what a typical credit report and credit score looks like, and then and how such a credit report is put together.
Well, I'll start by telling you where you can get the same credit report that lending institutions use. Most people assume that the reports that they're getting from Credit Karma or Credit Sesame or even directly from the credit bureaus themselves are the most accurate ones and the same one that lending institutions use. But in reality, each of the three bureaus quietly paid fines of $25 million last year because they were selling these bogus credit reports to people and telling them that's the same thing that lending institutions use. So I'll tell you a website that they don't like you to know about, but it's where you can get the same credit report that lending institutions use to assess what your rate is and whether you're going to get a loan. It is www.itdoesntfrigginexist.com. And it's because they don't want you to know how this whole thing works. They really don't. And if you were to go and ask your banker, hey, can I get a copy of my credit report that you guys are looking at? They're going to tell you, no, it's their bank policy not to give you that report. So one of the reasons why we dedicate so much of one chapter just to deciphering a credit report is because in it we tell you how to get the actual real deal report. And then we have to tell you how to read it, because it doesn't look at all like the cute and bubbly reports that you can get from any of the consumer sites. And the scores are different, so they don't give you the same score that the banks are looking at. So we tell you where to read it, how they're deciphering it, which one they're using. And that's why there's so much into this whole thing, is because you got to know how to read the real deal, not just the fake one that you're getting from these other bogus sites.
Why is it that the powers that be would not want us to be able to understand and appreciate our own credit reports? I mean, what is their motivation?
Money. If you don't know how this game is played, they're going to make more money off of you. And the average American has just under a 700 credit score nationwide. And that's not bad, but if you look at how much more you are paying in interest for your car loan, for your mortgage, for your credit cards and insurance policies, by having an average credit score versus a 740 A+, it adds up to several hundred thousand dollars in interest over your life. That's a lot of money. And you're not necessarily a bigger risk by being a 700 versus a 740, but they know they can make as much money off of you as possible, so they will.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anthony Davenport, talking about his book, Your Score, An Insider's Secrets to Understanding, Controlling, and Protecting Your Credit Score. So there are a couple of things that the typical consumer needs to be concerned about, and one of them is that in some cases our credit score is a relatively accurate reflection of who we are and what we've done financially and what our financial state is. And sometimes that credit report and credit score is rife with inaccuracies of one kind or another. So let's start there. How do inaccuracies typically enter one's credit report? And how is one to even detect the presence of inaccuracies and correct them?
Well, I'll start with how to detect them. You need to check your credit on a regular basis, and you should start by getting one of the real credit reports, seeing what's really on there. Now, as far as how inaccuracies come up, you have to remember that the credit bureaus, their sole job is to collect data on you and then sell it. That is how they make their money. You as a consumer are not a priority, and you're not a client of theirs. The banks and lending institutions that are reporting to them and paying them, those are the clients. So as a result, they're not really spending time, effort, and energy into making sure that the data that they're getting is correct. And in fact, in many cases, they're tying something to you by not verifying your full name, not verifying your address, not verifying your full social. They will only take, like, the first couple letters of your name and then a couple digits of your social and then maybe the city that you live in, and then they're saying that's good enough to tie it to this person. So, you know, 60 Minutes did a great piece called 40 Million Mistakes, and that's their assessment from a congressional review that said 40 million Americans have mistakes on their credit report, and the reason why is because the credit bureaus don't really care. They're not paid to care. And they're not really going to help you resolve this sort of thing because it's not in their interest.
So when it comes to elevating one's own credit score, at one point when you're kind of talking about this in the chapter titled Building the Perfect Credit Profile, you talk about one particular matter that should be addressed, and then you say, this is just one part of the beauty pageant. I love that choice of words that, you know, in a sense, one is trying to beautify oneself and beautify sort of one's public face when it comes to financial matters. So when someone has a credit score that is not what it needs to be, particularly if some kind of important transaction is coming up in their life, what are at least a couple of things that they need to think about in terms of addressing that issue?
So I always recommend that 90 days before you're going to apply for a loan, if not sooner, you need to obtain a copy of the real report that they're going to be looking at. And then you need to assess what ways you can use to improve it. And we even mentioned, like, there's a, you know, like a 90-day slam plan, essentially, if you need to do something quick, fast, and in a hurry. But I'll tell you one tip that's in there. People don't understand that credit card balances impact your FICO score to the tune of 30%, which is nearly as much as whether you pay your bills on time. And if you pay off your balances in full each month, you probably assume that you're good, but that's not accurate because the lending institutions only report to the credit bureaus typically every 30 to 45 days. So if you're going to apply for some financing, zero out or pay down your credit card balances as much as possible. Refrain from using them until after you get the mortgage or a loan that you're applying for. And that can boost your credit score by nearly as much as if you removed a whole bunch of late payments.
What is the difference between improving one's financial situation, the reality, versus changing the appearance of that financial situation? I think that's kind of a complicated question. I'm not asking it very elegantly, but I hope you can kind of understand what I'm getting at. I mean, one thing is about sort of appearances, and the other is about the reality of one's life and how you are handling your money. And I suspect that you're really talking about both things here.
Yeah, really, because the whole credit system is not an accurate gauge of whether you're going to pay someone back or not. In other countries, they look at, and this is going to shock you, but it's going to look at how much money you make, how much money you save, and where you keep your money. And that's what they determine whether you're going to get a loan. But here, we care so much about your score more than anything else that it is kind of a beauty pageant. And you need to make sure that you look as pretty as possible before you're going to get that loan. And the credit score is not super good at being indicative of whether you're going to pay a loan back. The difference between someone who has a 720 score and a 740 score defaulting is negligible. Not going to happen, really. There's really not a difference. But if you know how to make sure that your credit score is as high as possible, it can save you thousands of dollars for almost each type of transaction you're going to do that is credit score based.
By the way, you have a whole chapter that is devoted to the newbie. That is someone who is about to establish credit for the very, very first time. And for some of us, that's a now long distant memory. But it's possible that there might be somebody listening for whom that is going to be a reality in the very, very near future. In a nutshell, what should somebody in that situation be thinking about?
So you have to start thinking about the fact that lending institutions now are very much against lending to someone who doesn't have a proven track record. And that's something that's new since the recession. They used to give out credit to anyone who wanted it. But if you have, like, young kids that are, you know, turning 18, you know, they need to start establishing their credit early before they intend on using it, because credit and debt is going to be a major part of their lives. And they have to start thinking of how they want it to look. How can you help your kids build credit? And one of those ways is to add them as an authorized user, we call it, which will show the same length of credit history on the newbie's credit report as it will, you know, from the person who originally opened it. So, for example, when I went to college, my parents gave me a credit card and added me as an authorized user. On my credit report, it looked like I had a credit card since I was 2 years old. Like I'd been managing credit wisely since, you know, I was in diapers. And that's a real powerful way to help people kind of get into the game. And that's, you know, why we dedicated a whole chapter to that, because it may not apply to everyone, but odds are they're, if they have kids, they're going to have to go through the system at some point in time.
Right. That takes us to a nice place to finish, namely that this is a matter that is important to all of us, even though I think a lot of people go through much of life relatively oblivious to this, not realizing how this can matter, even outside of the major transactions for which, you know, always bring one's credit score immediately to mind. Remind our listeners why this should matter to all of us.
Should matter to all of us because we all have a credit profile, and none of us have been taught the right ways in which to manage or protect it. And if you don't pay attention to this, you may assume that just because you pay your bills on time, your credit's great, but in reality, you may just have the average credit profile, and it will cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars over your lifetime by not actively managing this.
The book again is Your Score, An Insider's Secrets to Understanding, Controlling, and Protecting Your Credit Score. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the author Anthony Davenport. Anthony Davenport, thank you for taking the time for this interview, and thank you for writing such a fascinating book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information online at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show on WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since